Morning, everyone. The Senate E-12 committee will come to order. Today's Wednesday, February 18, 2015. We have a few bills before us. First is Senate File 337, Senator Pappas, Directory Information. Welcome to the committee, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I do have an author's amendment, so I don't know if that's in your packet or not, or if it needs to be passed out.
It is. And Senator Pappas, once we have a quorum, we'll adopt that as a courtesy by one of the members.
The St. Paul School District brought this to me after meeting with both the city and the school library staff about a really exciting model in Nashville called Limitless Libraries. That's where the city and the school provide seamless services for students. So this will provide a much more efficient and equitable distribution of library cards across the district, make it much, much easier. Students will automatically get library cards. This is really a technical change to update the Minnesota Directory Information Law to conform with the last federal update. And the author's amendment actually reinstates the stricken language so that we have a more specific date and leave it at that. This district shared the information with in-house counsel of other metro districts, and it's also been reviewed and supported by the public law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. With me, I have Nancy Cameron, who is the general counsel for the district. She'll give you some brief background and is available to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Welcome, Ms. Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Nancy Cameron. I'm the general counsel for St. Paul Public Schools. By way of background, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which is commonly known as FERPA, a federal law, requires that school districts obtain a parent's written consent prior to the disclosure of personally identifiable information from a student's record. However, school districts may disclose personally identifiable information that has been designated as directory information without the written consent unless the parent has opted out of disclosure. The primary purpose of directory information and what this law that we're asking to be amended, the Minnesota law to be amended, relates to, the primary purpose of directory information is to allow the school districts to include information about a student in certain publications, for example, a playbill showing a student's role, the annual yearbook, honor roll, or other recognition lists. Under FERPA, directory information is information that is generally not considered harmful or an invasion of privacy to disclose. It may include the student's name, address, telephone, photograph, grade level, awards, degrees, and honors, to name a few. So FERPA allows a school district to disclose directory information without written consent if the school district has given parents proper notice. The notice must include the types of personally identifiable information that have been designated as directory information, parents' right to opt out of the disclosure of directory information, and the time period within which a parent has to notify the district that has opted out. What's new in the 2012 federal law is that the school district may specify in its notice that disclosure of directory information may be limited to specific parties for specific purposes or both. And the district must then limit the disclosure of directory information to the parties or purposes specified in the notice to the parents. St. Paul Public Schools, like many school districts, does not treat student addresses as directory information. It keeps student addresses private. Using the federal law, St. Paul schools would like to make addresses available to some parties, but not to all. For example, as Senator Pappas mentioned, St. Paul Schools is working towards a limitless library modeled after the Nashville program. And this is going to get library cards to public school students on a school-by-school basis by sharing the addresses with the St. Paul Public Library. And by the way, the St. Paul Public Library would consider addresses of its patrons to be private as well. So making the Minnesota law 1332 consistent with the federal law will allow us to share directory information, such as addresses, with parties we designate, for example, the library. But it won't force us to disclose that information to unnamed parties. like the media. So I'm asking for your support of Senate File 377 as amended.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Cameron, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, the school district and the library are already talking about coordinating around the curriculum so that when there's particular books or subject areas that students are doing research projects on, they'll be able to access the library. And also on their new iPads, they'll be able to access the library. So by automatically issuing them library cards, it's just going to make that educational experience more convenient for them and more supportive and useful.
Thank you. Questions or comments from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 337 as probably amended, once we have a quorum? Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, the Judiciary Committee has requested this bill. It's a data privacy bill, but we also would appreciate it if you would consider it for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Oh, dual track.
Yes. And Senator Pappas, once we have a quorum, absent any other testimony showing a compelling reason for us not to take action, I would expect we'll put it on a dual track. So,
Would you like us to stay until you take action in case there's any questions?
How about we'll contact you if needed?
Okay.
Otherwise, it should be in good hands.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Senator Pappas and Ms. Cameron.
Thank you.
Now, Senator Johnson, I believe one of your testifiers is en route.
Correct, so, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Claussen is presenting bills, and Senator next door, and we'll be back. Senator Kiffmeyer, are your testifiers here yet?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I believe they are.
Great. Well, we can take in whichever order you want. We have Senate Files 429 and Senate File 430, authored by Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of things going on this morning. Glad to be with you and very pleased that my testifier, Professor Palmer, happened to be here early. And I said when you have these kind of schedules going on, you never know what can happen. And this is a case in point that I hope it's helpful. And so, Mr. Chairman, I have two bills in front of you today, Senate File 429 and Senate File 430. Both of these Senate files do deal with the same topic or the same issue, so many of our comments are related to each bill. Senate File 429 in particular has to do with courses according to agreements. In this regard, the specific language says the course offered under the subdivision must use the same syllabus, final exam, and grading scale as the equivalent course offered at the eligible public post-secondary system or an eligible private post-secondary institution. My testifier today will address why we feel it is necessary to include this kind of language. The second bill, Senate File 430, has to do, again, with the same subject, but would require a study in addition to these standards. So I would also call your attention to a handout that I have in your packet, which talks about the education policy analysis about dual enrollment course content and instructor quality. So there are some things I've underlined there that will be helpful. But with that, Mr. Chair, if be okay with you, I would have my testifier, Professor Palmer, proceed with his comments at this time, if that's okay.
Yes, thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer, and welcome.
Well, thank you, Chairman. My name is John Palmer, and I live in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I'm completing my 39th year, academic year of service at St. Cloud State University. It will be my last. So the next time I might appear in a future session, I'll be Professor Emeriti instead of Professor. I don't come this today representing the university. I come representing the interests that I have both as a citizen, as a grandparent, and as a person who has watched the benefits occurring to the state for offering post-secondary options to young people. I have two daughters who have gone and graduated with bachelor's degree, one of which received considerable credit under the AP program. The other chose not to participate. And I have a grandson who will be 16 in a month that is in the St. Paul schools, and I suspect soon will be interested in post-secondary offerings. My focus today is on an element of the program that some people may not even be aware happens. I had occasion this morning to talk to Representative Lyndon Carlson, who I've known for quite some time, and he asked why I was here, and I mentioned that I was here about post-secondary. And the conversation was such that he found out by chance that one of his grandchildren was taking a concurrent enrolled class at Becker High School, and he presumed that it might be a St. Cloud State class, and I pointed out to him that post-secondary options, concurrent enrollment, are possible from lots of locations. It could be from Fond du Lac Community College. It could be from Central Lakes Community College. It could be from Southwest State. There are almost all of the public post-secondary institutions are in this marketplace and provide contractual services to the school districts. I also related to him that a faculty colleague found out by chance that their son was enrolled in a class when the son was headed off to the exercise center at the local community college. So I want to make sure that the committee is aware of the fact that even though PSEO is popularly known and started with concurrent enrollment where students travel to the campus and took classes with college students, that's its origin, is not the majority of what is now known as PSEO. The majority of the activity occurs in the high schools, taught by high school teachers under a contractual relationship between a post-secondary and that high school. There is a contract that is executed that makes that possible. The diversity of what occurs is quite wide. In the investigations that colleagues of mine have brought to my attention, we have come to know that the delivery of these services equals 18,000 full-year equivalent students. I want you to pause and think about that 18,000 number. There is only one public university in the state of Minnesota that is larger than 18,000 FYE. That's the University of Minnesota. So what we have is a system of delivering instruction that is fragmented across all of the MinSCU schools and all of the University of Minnesota schools that essentially is generating the equivalent of the second largest public university, the equivalent of full-time students in the state. My investigations have been limited. That is to say, they've been done on an ad hoc basis. They have not been comprehensive in their thrust. In visiting with Senator Kiffmeyer, she kindly took on this task of looking at how do we preserve the benefits that are associated with post-secondary options at the same time that we protect the interests of the young people that are receiving a service that may or may not be the equivalent of a college class. I have information that tells me that even though one of our institutions requires that a syllabus be made available, an updated syllabus annually, that out of 110 required syllabi to be submitted, only 69 were turned in at the end of the year. From my examination, there isn't a mechanism of oversight and enforcement of standards. There's a voluntary accrediting body, but when it comes to enforcing what those standards are, it's like what I used to teach my driver ed students. What's the speed limit? Is it what's posted on the sign, or is what's enforced? And with a little or no enforcement, we have a divergence of practice. At one institution, we have two faculty that are teaching full-time loads. That's 10 credits or 10 courses a year that are also assigned to 45 and 43 sections of college and the high school programming. At my institution, I'm aware of faculty who have been mentors to high school teachers who have not been in the United States at the time that the classes were being taught. I offer this to you to say that there is a limited amount of knowledge about the extent to which there are problems with the program, problems in quality, problems in delivery. And somebody might ask me, why would I travel down to St. Paul as a person in approaching retirement, getting up at 5:30 this morning to make sure I made it here by 8:30 with such a limited interest? My interest has been and will remain focus on the high school students. I simply ask that the committee consider favorably both bills so that questions like how much is being charged for service by each post-secondary provider might be known, and how are the faculty being compensated for their work? What kind of work is being contracted for between the school districts and the universities? And how do the students who receive credits under continuing in concurrent enrollment fare in follow-up or subsequent college classes? I do believe that as a minimum starting point, a standard of requiring in statute a current syllabus is a good start. I also believe that the initiation of a study will allow then an informed set of choices and options to improve what has grown to be, as I said earlier, the second largest public university in the state, that is the university of the whole, that delivers 18,000 FYEs on an annual basis. With that, I'm happy to respond to questions.
Thank you, Professor Palmer, and for your nearly 40 years of service in education.
It won't be 40. It'll only be 39.
Nearly. Okay.
Okay. Precise.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kiffmeyer, I see the study. What if the study, the results show that same syllabus, final exam, same grading scale is not the best approach? So are we, in 429, are we maybe getting ahead of what might be really the best approach for concurrent enrollment?
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, members. I considered both of those to be an important part. There is a great deal of presumption that what we talk about here as far as standards, the same syllabus, the final exam and grading scale, there's a big presumption that, after all, if you're taking a college course in high school, that you would be using the same syllabus, that you'd be using the same final exam and grading scale. There's a big presumption of that. And so we're being explicit here, but supposedly at this time, and most of us, I think, would say we have a fair expectation that if they're taking a college course in the high school, that how else could you call it a college course in the high school if it did not use the same practical curriculum, exams, and so on that were there in the college course? I mean, I think you connect those two. The study is not really designed for saying necessarily what is the best. The study is more designed to understand what is actually happening today. In other words, is there any difference between a concurrent enrollment course? And so we're trying to get a sense of current practice. One states, we think this is what it should be, and the study says, but what is? And so the difference between a concurrent enrollment course and the sponsoring higher ed syllabus, grading scale, and so on. So it's a study that is not designed to say, is that the best way to do it, but to understand what are we doing right now? Where is that? So that we can have a better understanding for the future. But I think most parents, most students would say that this is a good idea, the concurrent enrollment. But I think what really fueled me was also experiences with my grandkids and friends talking to other professors who said, here is how I mentor, this is how I do. And that is the same final exam, the same grading, the same syllabus, working closely with the teacher in the high school to make sure that that student truly, when they're taking a college course in the high school, that if they were in a college situation, that content would be the same and the grading, because that's what we really want our young people to have in that kind of experience. But what I found out was his experience is this is not necessarily how everybody does it. And so the taxpayers who are paying, the parents who are thinking this is what's happening, the student who unwittingly is just doing what those around them are telling them and so on, what if, in fact, in some cases, they are getting what we are paying for and expecting? And I think there are those who are doing a very good job. What about unwittingly others who are not? And we certainly have examples and cases. When you have 43 and 45 sections to mentor, how can you do a fair job if the distance is so great between the entities that sponsor and the high schools? How can you do a fair job? And I think those are questions that the taxpayers and the parents and the students need an answer for. Because sometimes when you have something that gets so popular, everybody jumps in on it, and there's a presumption that may not bear out, and the study will be very helpful. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm open to both of these. I want to do my homework for the committee to submit to you what I think is the expectation by explicitly putting it in the bill, and the other one is a study to examine if that indeed is happening.
Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a co-author on the bill, I'd just like to say, Senator Dahl, our goal here was to align with the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Standards. And so I don't think we're necessarily getting our cart before the horse. We do need to do the study and find out what's right. But aligning ourselves with the national standards, which some of our institutions do and some don't, brings some consistency to the program overall. And so that's why I signed on to the bill with Senator Kiffmeyer.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you will find that in there's a course content and instructor quality study that's in your packet. And I went through it and underlined what I felt were the more pertinent sections. And Minnesota is mentioned in here, matter of fact. I believe it is on, let's see, page, my glasses on.
Page 5, I believe.
Page 5, okay. At the very top. And
third
so
paragraph.
In Minnesota's current statute, you might say that we're aligned to the standards. However, are you in reality? And it was kind of interesting to say that you can provide these dual course enrollment, but they may or may not. You can substitute, and there's so much flexibility that you really end up with, are you truly aligned to the NACEP standards, or is there so much flexibility that, in fact, it is, does have no real genuine meaning? And I think we should know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. We have also referred to Senate File 430, 429 initially before us, but we'll entertain comments on both bills and also ask if there's anyone in the audience that would like to provide testimony. Yes.
Okay.
We'll note a quorum's present.
Here.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Ado Shuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Education. I've had the opportunity to communicate with the senator about some of the minor concerns that the department has and look forward to working with the author going forward, particularly with Senate File 430, the concurrent enrollment study, and just some of the limitations at the department going forth, some limitations I think members have probably heard on past bills to conduct studies. So familiar arguments, I'm sure, but we have to put it on the record. So consulting with our analytics staff, MDE currently as it stands, doesn't have the data systems capacity to conduct this study. It would probably require more funding to build up the systems and build up the staff. We would have to collect post-secondary course information, syllabi, final exams, grading practice, and prerequisites, things that we don't collect at the moment. So it's not only from actual systems, but also from staff capacity as well. We may have some issues collecting course syllabi from post-secondary faculty. Pardon me, who do have the authority to change their syllabi. There's some issues about proprietary information there. That's something I think we would have to investigate just a little bit further. Our statewide longitudinal education system, SLEDS, doesn't currently have the capacity or data sharing permissions to track the tens of thousands of courses offered and taken by students, or tracking the acceptance or denial of credits at post-secondary institutions within the state or across the country. And just speaking to Senate File 429 shortly about the standards and aligned to the NASEP standards and programs, we have a statute that requires that for secondary institutions to, or districts to receive concurrent enrollment aid, the post-secondary institutions that offer them the concurrent enrollment courses have to be accredited by NASEP, in the process of being accredited, or have signed an assurance verification that the courses are comparable in quality and standards to NASEP accredited programs. I certainly recognize, you know, the point that the senator made at the end, are they truly aligned? But the statute does require either alignment or assurances that they are aligned to those standards.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Chair, Johnson.
The question that came to my mind is, Mr. Chair and maybe Professor Palmer, have the instructors found a lack of knowledge coming from the students that have a PSEO program in their high school, and when they go into the class at college, are the instructors in the classrooms aware when the students have a PSEO enrollment?
Professor Palmer,
Senator and Chairman, the answer is anecdotal. The reason it's anecdotal is, a comprehensive examination of that question has not been undertaken. I can tell you that a good friend of mine was an early adopter in producing a chemistry offering. His experience was that when they went to the comprehensive exam in chemistry, that a large number of the students who received A's could not pass the test that was administered. So what I'm suggesting to you is that even in the in a rigorous setting in which the partnership happened, when the department administered its comprehensive exam, a significant number of students were not able to have success. Now, keep in mind, I said they got A's. They got A's because there was a partnership between the grading with the college faculty member in the high school. There are significant problems that occur when we do not document the achievement of the students. My comment about the posted speed limit and the enforced speed limit is relevant. I have no doubt that the Department of Education is doing the best they can with the way the statutes are and the resources that they have available. But if no one is watching, and there are tremendous economic forces at work here, there's a real incentive to from post-secondaries to bolster their enrollment. At my institution, 3,300 of our freshmen or of our students in the fall of last year were high school students. So when you hear St. Cloud State has 19,000 students, 3,300 of them never come to our campus. I have grave doubts about what is happening to a program that has little or no oversight, and that's the reason I support the bill on the syllabus, which at least puts it in statute that it would be there. And I do think a study needs to be undertaken to capture what actually is occurring.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe for those members that didn't hear your initial disclaimer, you're not representing St. Cloud, though. You obviously have nearly 40 years of experience as a professor, and I checked your bio.
I've also been I've been on the other side, the dark side. I've been a Minsky administrator. I was faculty association president, so I was the union president of the local. And then I was management, so I've been on both sides there.
Three sides, almost.
Almost three sides. And as Senator Kiffmeyer and I have been known to do, we sing the national anthem at political conventions. So that kind of reveals what my political involvements have been. I jokingly referred, I mean, I have to ask myself, am I in my right mind to get up at 5:30 in the morning to come down to testify on a bill that marginally affects a career that I've had. And I care about good scholarship. I care about upholding academic standards. I care about engaging in best practice. And when my wife asked me what I was going to testify to today as I left the house, she put it quite simply. What you're going to testify to is we really don't know what it is that we're delivering to the young people that take these classes. We don't. The senator asks an excellent question. We should know. We should know what level of achievement is occurring. And that troubles me for the future of our young people and the future of our state, that these are minimal steps. I have people who are not very happy that Senator Kiffmeyer was as timid as she is when offering these bills.
Timid. Wow.
Well, I know.
Not known usually.
She's not known as being timid. But you know, there are those that are passionate about the fact that there are problems here that are not addressed, not being addressed. And so that's why I came down today.
And Mr. Chairman, there are those that we really respect both the high schools, higher education. We see there's a lot of good people. And for me, it's really important that we can apply what needs to be done on a common sense basis, on a sound principle here, without having to go into other things that I think would be more unpleasant to deal with, because I don't think it's necessary. I think this is one of those things that we should do. And, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff with the Higher Education Committee has also requested these to come before her as well. And there may be other questions yet, but I wanted to be sure and mention that, or we can, I don't know quite how, if it can be laid over for possible inclusion and moved on to higher ed. This committee may want to have further input on this subject as well.
Yes, we would. When we're entertaining questions, comments on both Senate Files 429 and 430, I'm going to call on Senator Claussen, but wanted to check, is there anyone in the audience that would also like to provide testimony? Okay, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, I was presenting a bill across the hall, so I'm getting here late into the conversation. But I also have looked at Senator Kiffmeyer's bill. A question I would have for our testifier is St. Cloud State University a member of the National Association of Concurrent Enrollment Institutions?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, and what troubles me is I have a report that says that in the academic year 2013-2014, the department responsible for managing the program received only 69 of 101 of the required syllabi to be shared annually.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
Senator Klassen.
This past fall, I visited 15 schools that have concurrent enrollment programs, and I found that there are vast differences between the University of Minnesota College and the schools program. They've done several studies addressing some of the issues that you've identified, and if you look at the association's requirements of the institutions to join, there are pretty strict requirements that they have that address many of the issues mm-hmm. that are in the bill. So I find it somewhat puzzling that this is coming forward, quite honestly. And I think, too, just based upon the 15 visits that I made, that those institutions, high schools, that have agreements with the University of Minnesota and Minsky institutions, there are vast differences in how they are administered. And so I find this more as an internal issue with Minsky institutions than an overriding issue regarding concurrent enrollment programs in the state of Minnesota.
Senator and Chairman.
Yes, Professor Palmer.
Mm-hmm. My colleagues have tried to pursue these kinds of questions within the Minsky organization, within the university. At each turn where additional information became available, it became more troubling. Having been in education now for about 45 years, both post-secondary and secondary, accreditation standards everyone wants to meet at the time that the accrediting visit happens. But after the accrediting visit happens, often practices deviate away from that. Accrediting bodies have limited resources to go out and determine what's occurring. That what I'm saying is everyone is going to present the best possible picture to an accreditor. When I look at the anecdotal information, I wonder how, at our institution, someone who's teaching a full load has 20 sections of mentorship to do at the same time they have a full load. And often, they have additional overload that they're doing in teaching classes or in doing research. And I simply ask myself the question, how much of a person can be sold at any one time? My answer is only 100%. And I wonder which of the many assignments are not being done. I simply want the committee to know that there are anecdotes, that there are issues here that Senator Kiffmeyer wishes to bring before you in her bills to begin a process of examination. Oversight, in and of itself, will have an effect of increasing quality because they'll know somebody's looking.
And, Mr. Chairman, I also want to add to this because I'm not quite sure which members joined a little bit later and heard some of the previous information. But one of the things important to realize that in Minnesota statute, even if you are certified and you're connected with NASEP, our Minnesota law says all you have to do is give an assurance. Not any proof, not any documentation, not any going through all of that, but simply an assurance, that kind of loophole, if nothing else, gives a great opening as that fits in with the rest of Professor Palmer's comments.
Senator Klassen.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. I go back to my statement. I think this is a Minsky issue. If you look at the University of Minnesota and all the studies they've done, that testify to the fact about the success of these students, the graduation rate, graduating on time, indicate that that's a very successful program. If you look again at the Minsky programs, it's very much site-based at each of the institutions. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest there needs to be oversight on Minsky's behalf to make sure that those programs are running correctly. I had many visits, as I mentioned before, with school districts, and basically they said what a lot of the Minsky institutions are interested in is collecting $3,500 to run the program, and you never see them again, versus the summer sessions that teachers go to at the University of Minnesota, the visits that the professors make at the high schools coming from the colleges to review the program. So I think, again, this is a Minsky issue. And I just want to make it clear it's not a condemnation on concurrent enrollment, but rather this is a Minsky issue. I just want to make that clear. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate Senator Claussen's comments. You know, we should be looking at this as a best practice. We've had a let's call it a pilot. We've had a pilot where we've administered it one way and another. And I think, Mr. Rooney, the issue for the study is to confirm which oversight model works the best. And so maybe I'll work with Senator Kiffmeyer on an amendment that puts the DOE as well as the Office of Higher Ed jointly responsible for this report, because I think you both have a stake in it, and that we should, I think Senator Claussen just raised an interesting point, look at on-time graduation rates from higher ed institutions is one of the outcomes, because we're between the two committees that Senator Claussen, Kent, and I sit on, and Bonoff is talking about college affordability and on-time graduation, and when you've got schools out there like Shakopee that are claiming that they've saved students over $1 million in tuition, and you've got other schools that we should know. By program, what those graduations are. We should know by program what those credit acceptance rates are. And so if it helps that we bring in the Office of Higher Ed, I think that's something that maybe we should do to help this report get done and to help it be complete and comprehensive. So I appreciate your comments earlier, and I'll work with Senator Kiffmeyer to, mm-hmm. to hopefully make that change. And I hope that's acceptable to the department.
Mr. Chairman, the department and I have had an email discussion in regards to this, to refining the language, to working on it, and also all of your comments today as well, and will be definitely and absolutely considered. And Senator Claussen, I have heard the same thing, good statements about the University of Minnesota. Matter of fact, most frequently it was, we should require Minsky to do it the same as the University of Minnesota, and that is why I did 429, because that is just a very brief and a very short way, without getting into a huge amount of language, to make an effort to accomplish that, and yet on the other hand, the study, because I submit that to you and also to the Higher Ed Committee, that I expect that good input will be included so that we do accomplish some of those goals and do it as well as we can. But I think the need to do it is very clear.
Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm going to suggest in that spirit that we lay each of these over with the instruction that we have discussions with the parties that have expressed suggestions, ideas, whether it be the department, Senator Claussen, Senator Pratt, and others with some thoughts, Senator Bonoff, who is probably presenting another bill, but because we have a overlap with this committee, we could probably get four or five people together that could craft some better language rather than sending it with some unresolved issues at this point. So would you feel okay if we laid them over with the intent of that type of discussion continuing, and then we'll get a report back within 2 weeks.
Mr. Chairman, I'm okay with that, Mr. Chairman. I would want to make sure that we meet our deadline and that we need to have a committee take an action, a definite action. And the other thing that I'm also interested in, I think when you go in front of a committee, you have the minds of the committee members, their staff, and those who are here. And I would be eager to be able to get that kind of input from the higher ed committee as well. While I appreciate everything we have here, I think they have some expertise in the room that would be very beneficial to be able to get that as well. I don't know how you handle that, Mr. Chair, but that's just my comment.
Senator Kiffmeyer, I think there's those discussions that can be going on right now to lay foundation.
Okay.
And I think it's better served with some of this ultimately returning back and then with the potential fiscal implication and related policy matters that we continue the discussion. But you have my word that this will reappear for a continued discussion.
Okay.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Maybe it might be appropriate to refer this without recommendation to higher ed, have a hearing and bring it back fully vetted to this committee for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill then. And I'm just offering that as a possible suggestion to keep this bill moving. And we'll have one more chance to hear it after it's been vetted by higher ed, so that Senator Clausen, Kent, Torres Ray, and I can bring the feeling of this committee to that discussion as well.
I believe we could do that. I mean, it's going to return here mm-hmm. in any event.
Right.
There's a lot of, there's work that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. I believe 4:30 should go to finance and then because of the anticipated fiscal note, we could mandate the department to eat that, I suppose. And but the financial implication is clear. So I guess I'll ask for whatever the division's pleasure is on this. It's my intent that we try to, as Senator Bonnef would say, mm-hmm. meet in the middle and work this out so that we can accomplish what would serve the best interests of students. Okay. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I concur with Senator Pratt's recommendation. We actually had a very vigorous conversation in higher education yesterday regarding issues of transparency and accountability in programs and loan disclosure, because students go in with one understanding and they come out with a different amount of experience and credit transferability and that kind of thing. I think this is very much in alignment with things that we are already discussing in higher ed. And I agree that the group of us here would be very eager to continue these discussions in that spirit.
And if Senator Bonnef was here, I'm sure she would reiterate that, and recognizing that the committee is actively engaged on that. I would suggest that Senator Kiffmeyer move that Senate File 429 be referred to the Higher Ed Committee without recommendation.
Okay.
Discussion? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, carried. And on Senate File 430, Senator Kiffmeyer moves that it be referred to Finance Committee without recommendation. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, can you explain? I'm not quite sure. What does that mean when it goes to Finance Committee? So, okay.
excuse me, Senator Kiffmeyer. Because of the financial implication, we're in a policy committee right now, and
right.
It would need to look at the underwriting aspect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forgot to look at the headline of the committee I was in today, and I understand now. And thank you very much. I appreciate that.
But yes, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if maybe we couldn't refer this to the policy committee for higher ed as well, work on it, and send this bill to finance out of higher ed then.
I think there's nothing that precludes higher ed from discussing, this subject, but I would rather have it go through finance right now with the financial implication. Recognizing that we have our policy and our finance, and ultimately it comes together.
But thank you, Mr. Chair. I think with the fact that 429 goes to higher ed, the content of the study can be a subject for discussion without them to having the actual bill in front of them. So I think we can work that out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
Senator Kiffmeyer renews her motion for Senate Call 430 as stated. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. And thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer, and thank you, Professor Palmer, for your service.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, we started without a quorum on Senate File 337, and I'm going to ask Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul School District. Senator Pappas presented the bill, also Nancy Cameron. It's non-controversial, and there was an author's amendment which Senator Johnson's going to offer. And there was no one expressing opposition in the audience, and so and this needs to be referred to the judiciary. Ms. Gilbert, if you could just restate 30 seconds
right.
or so summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools, and simply this is really a technical update to our directory information statute. And all it does is changes the date from January 1st, as amended, from January 1st, 2007 to January 3rd, 2012, which is the last time the federal government updated that. For any of you who have any questions about the federal role, since we have it referenced in here, there is information in your packet that would explain it. And if any of you have any questions, it just school districts in the 2012 update have a little more authority to have limited release of information. Right now, under the current law, you either have to give it to everybody or nobody. And the 2012 update says that as long as you provide notice to parents who you're going to give it to and what the purpose is, parents still have the opportunity to refuse to consent, and they just have to notify us. And so that's simply all it does.
Members, we have a technical amendment. It was an author's amendment, and Senator Johnson moves the A1 amendment. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. And Senator Johnson moves that Senate File 337 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Further questions or comments? Not all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you. We have two remaining bills, Senate File 524, Senator Claussen. You will be next. And I recognize some of the members have other bills they're presenting, and I think this would do it. And he'll be followed by Senator Johnson on charter schools. Senator Claussen, and we invite you to ask any of your testifiers to join you if you would like. Senate File 524.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps Katie Perkle and Candace Raskin can come up, and that will save some time then as we call people up. Well, good morning, Chairman Wieger and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 524, which provides a grant appropriation from the Commissioner of Education to support effective leadership training for school principals. And at this time, I'd like to submit the A3 amendment.
Is that before us? Okay, and Senator Claussen, it's being distributed.
I can just make a few comments?
Yes, if you could,
okay.
Then it'll be...
The amendment restores previous language that's found in the original statute and then also removes Section 1, Subdivision 3. So a lot of it is simply restoring some of the original language and then removing a subsection.
I want to make sure everybody has it in front of them before we act. And we will soon, but perhaps
like to
Ms.
move on.
Kell, if you'd like to move on.
I'll move on.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The legislature established funding the Principals Leadership Institute in 2005 in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Education Minnesota Elementary and Secondary Principals Association, and also the University of Minnesota. The Minnesota Principals Leadership Institute has trained over 300 principals using a research-based National School Institute for School Leadership Program. In addition, Minnesota State Mankato also has instituted a leadership training program, the Institute for Courageous Principal Leadership, approximately 4 years ago. Unfortunately, funding was discontinued during the 2010 legislative session for the principals program, and Senate File 524 restores funding for effective leadership training for principals. At this time, I'd like to introduce Katie Perkle, principal in residence at the University of Minnesota, who will offer testimony.
Ms. Pickell.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your time this morning. As Senator Klassen indicated, I am the principal in residence for the University of Minnesota, which means I serve in a temporary capacity where they bring someone from the world of practice into the university to bridge research to practice and practice to research. My primary responsibility at the University of Minnesota is twofold. I oversee the Minnesota Principals Academy, the Executive Development Program for School Principals before you today, and I coordinate two federal IES grants that oversees the evaluation of a college readiness program in 140 schools throughout the state of Minnesota. We are very interested in seeing restored funding to the Principal Leadership Institute because we know that the school principals need to have ongoing professional development after initial licensure. I think you received information in your packets regarding the program specifically, the curriculum used, and how we approach that instruction. And while I could certainly answer questions regarding that, I think you might be more interested in hearing from two of our participants, one who participated earlier in the program and one who is a current participant in the program who are here with me today.
Thank you, Ms. Pickell. And we do have the A3 offers amendment distributed. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye. Aye.
Adopted. Please continue.
Could we call on Candace Ruskin next? Then we'll have the two participants speak.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Committee, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about a passion. I'm Candace Raskin. I'm currently the chair and a professor at Minnesota State Mankato, and I actually operate in the Edina campus. So we have a graduate center there, and we run a lot of our programming out of that center, and that's also where we run our academy. So why am I here? My previous career prior to 6 years ago was a teacher, kindergarten, sixth grade. Then I was an elementary principal, middle school principal, and a superintendent. And I moved to the university with a passion of not just creating leaders, but figuring out how universities partner alongside leaders once they're in the field. And so that's where the work came. And I want to just read a piece where our call to action came from, because right now, in this era of really unprecedented educational challenge, our institute is committed to the continuous development of principals so they can lead with fearlessness, with skill, with knowledge, and courage that they're doing the right work and they know how to do it. And so that's really the call to action. So my full-time job is preparing initial principals. Through the Center for Engaged Leadership, our university and our dean has allowed us to create this institute where we partner with schools. And what we are really looking at is we're looking at transforming principal preparation and transforming what we do alongside principals. Our program's research-based. It's really about leading courageously. And we really address racial competence, which I think is absolutely key right now. We're working on eliminating disparities of achievement, leadership, teaching, and participation in schools. And I'm really proud to say in 4 years, we are now partnering with 14 districts, urban, suburban, and rural, and we currently work with 101 principals. And starting this summer, we will be up to serving 150 principals. So what are we looking at? What are we trying to do? We're trying to make this work about high-leverage leadership practices. We want to increase our principals' ability to advance education equity. It's absolutely critical. We want to eliminate racial predictability of our students' test scores. And we believe that that can be done, that leverage point is really through leadership. We want to build the capacity of our leaders. Our institute's a two-year institution. It's the institute's 2 years. It's job embedded. It's real time. The participants are using their data, and we have added an on-site coaching component using practitioners in the field to provide coaching and support. And that's really been a key piece. We're studying the Institute because not only this is a lot of work. This is the U's work, our work. This is the work of universities. We all need to be engaged in this work. No one institution has the capacity to do this. And so we're really studying what we're doing to make sure that we are impacting ultimately the achievement of all students in our schools. So each participant bring. So what we've recently we just completed our first study, and our first cohort has graduated, and we found the results were the results were significant. We had significant shifts in the principals' views of their own leadership capacity, and there were three areas that were over 70% shift, and that's the area of leading for race and equity, understanding their leadership strengths, really knowing how they lead, and also using high-leverage leadership practices. So being knowledgeable about what practices really affect student achievement. We also assessed their supervisors to see how their supervisors felt about their leadership capacities at the end of the year, and it was amazing. They were absolutely aligned. Where the principals felt that they had leadership capacity has grown, we also found that the supervisors aligned directly with that. We're currently looking at 9 of the schools because we really want to drill down, does this increase student achievement? So we're taking 9 of the principals that were in our first institute, and we're pulling the data from 2 years before they were institute, 2 years while they were institute, and the 2 years afterwards. And we're drilling down to say, okay, does this really make a difference in the practices and the behaviors of our principals in the institute? And we're currently involved in that. Our first set of research was accepted to be published in the American Association for School Administrators in Practice, and that will be published in July. And I guess I just want to close with this work is about making a difference in schools. This work is about really changing the trajectory of what's occurring for students. And I just commend Senator Klassen for bringing forward a bill to not just prepare principals, but to sit alongside them to ensure that they're really leading with the capacity that needs to occur. I do, if I can have a page, I do have our curriculum, which is a 2-year curriculum for you to review. If I could have someone distribute I would really appreciate it. Someone told me a nice-looking gentleman would pass these out for me, so
thank you. Thank you, Ms. Grant. I think you said that the Academy teaches to be fearless.
Fearless, with confidence. One thing I didn't mention, so our work is based on the research that's out there. Most of it is the Wallace Foundation, the 70 studies. But we've added, there's 7 major things that you need to be effective principals. But we've added 2 different pieces that we think make us very unique, and that's the racial equity work. And it's also the ability to have the confidence to know that you're using the right practices and that you're implementing the right practices in your school. So those are 2 strands that do make our work unique.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a quick question about one of the handouts that we have has a map of the state of Minnesota on it. And I noticed that there's there's 3 areas that don't have any dots in it. And on the back side, I looked at the list, and there really aren't any school districts or schools from Senate District 1, which is up in the northwest corner. So my obvious thought is, what are you doing to make this program work for the whole state of Minnesota? At the same time, I noticed that St. Paul had 44 principals that went through the program, and I think it's great that they had that many go through the program, but I definitely think it's a program that should be statewide in application.
Mr. Chair, I'll respond to that. You will notice that the concentration has been in the metropolitan area. One of the pieces that was we were hoping to see happen through this legislation is a guaranteed for a cohort to exist in the regional areas of the state. For example, Senator Stumpf, we are looking to start a cohort in Thief River Falls this summer. So that is one of the advantages of that we hoped to achieve through this legislation. It would then be our intention that regional cohort would move every 2 years. So, for example, we would do one in the Northwest. The following 2 years, we would do one, for example, maybe in the Northeast, the Southeast, depending upon the need and as advised by the School Principals Associations.
I would like to just address, we're in our infancy, so this is our fourth year, but one of the areas, 7700 France has amazing Cisco telepresence technology, and we currently connect to northern Minnesota and southern Minnesota through that technology. We teach our doctorate program through that. So we are exploring right now how we can connect through our virtual telepresence system, which is like us sitting in a circle, bringing the individuals remotely into our institute.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I think that that's absolutely a good thought. I know there has to be some hands-on, but when you look at greater Minnesota, whether it's northwest or southwest, distance is obviously a challenge. I think the University of Minnesota Crookston, over half of the classes that they teach are online classes. And they're literally the same identical class that they would have taught if students come to the campus. So I think the tools are available. So I would strongly urge you to make the program expand out to those areas that that are not being served right now.
Senators Dames, Hoffman, Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not just sure who wants to answer my first question. I got two of them. The first one, how is the Minnesota State University involved in this process?
Mr. Raskin.
At Mankato.
How are we involved in this process?
Yes.
Well, when I spoke to you earlier, what we're interested in is we started – there's a lot of work to be done, and so 4 years ago we started an institute, and we would really love for our institute to be included in helping serve Minnesota.
Okay. And then thank you. And, Mr. Chair, a follow-up. Just another comment is that I certainly would like to support Senator Stump's opinions on rural Minnesota. In fact, I'd really like to see you folks make sure that there's some equity in the offerings and that rural Minnesota has the same opportunities that our metro folks do as far as our principals to attend these academies or online or something like that. So I really think that that's important, and I would really like to see this bill put some teeth into it so that there is a requirement that rural Minnesota gets served in this process.
Mr. Chair.
Yep. Senator Clausen.
Just a comment on that. I assume we're going to be coming back to this committee for the second round, right?
Yes.
And we can work on an amendment that identifies the two senators' concerns and put that into the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Clausen, I still get this academy. 2 years ago, I asked the same kind of question. You know, the Metro EXU does since 1984, the Principal's Academy, that has been around for a while, and I don't know if all the EXUs statewide do those, but can you help me understand what this Principal's Academy does that's different than what's been around since 84 through the Educational Cooperative Service Units, or is that something you want to talk about offline? I just always wondered. There's two different ones out there, and I'm getting them confused.
No, I can attempt to address that, Senator Hoffman. I think what we're looking at, the two programs that are testifying here today, are much more in depth. They're much more research based. They're much more looking at follow up studies to make sure that they're effective programs. Not to criticize the EXU programs, I think they're good programs. I'm not as familiar with those. It's been several years since I looked at those programs, and I'm not sure if in all areas those are still running. I think the one in the metro area is, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure it's on an every year basis. But I think the two programs that we're looking at have a broader reach across the state of Minnesota, and the research-based, I think, makes a big difference.
Senator Hoffman.
And Mr. Chair, yeah, if I remember right, the they spend a whole year. It's like 2.5 hours a month, or they get together as principals, and I think it's still going on. But I'll just, you know, we'll talk more about this as it progresses through the process. So thank you for bringing this, by the way.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Clausen, I like the idea of professional development. It's always good. And it kind of tags, this question kind of tags on, or it's a tale of Senator Stump and Senator Dames. And I'm not questioning your amendment, but could you clarify why then, why on page 2, lines 28 to 31 have been deleted? If we're talking about a broader scope, so it kind of tails on to the previous question, but just clarify why you deleted that piece.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Chamberlain. My feeling was that both programs are moving in that direction. They already have some presence in outstate Minnesota. Didn't want to necessarily mandate that, knowing that they already have some of those programs, that they already are moving in that direction. So that's why it's been taken out of the bill. But after hearing concerns, I'll certainly work on an amendment placing that back into the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Clausen.
Thank you. We have at least four or five others, I believe, that are to testify. I'd like us to wrap up by 10 o'clock so we can get to Senator Johnson's bill. I think it's safe to say the committee recognizes the value, the importance of the academy, and the additional area to work on is making sure there's an amendment to have the outstate Greater Minnesota needs addressed, and then ultimately how much we might be able to partner in terms of resources. So the path would be to re-refer this to finance, when then it would come to us as a finance division. So for subsequent testifiers, if you're in support, I believe that we understand that and appreciate, you know, your, you know, sharing that with us, but we would like to be done by about 10.
Okay. We'll move on then, Mr. Chair. You'll perhaps recognize the next two testifiers. They're from your home district, Mr. Chair. Peter Mao, Supervisor of Educational Programs, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale Public Schools, and Eric Fort, Assistant Principal at Tartan High School.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Wieger, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you here today. As mentioned, my name is Peter Mao. I am a principal on special assignment in the North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale School District and have spent 11 years as a principal, nine of which were as an elementary school principal, and the last two I have spent in the role of supporting and coaching principals in my district. Looking through some of my notes here and thinking of your remarks, Senator Wieger, I will pare down some of what I had planned on saying. I think ultimately, as a former participant in Minnesota Principals Academy and as a current facilitator, I just want to relay to the committee that the program has had a significant impact on me professionally. Research is clear that principal leadership is second only to teacher quality in the impact on student learning. And indeed, principal leadership has a significant impact itself on teacher quality. This is a key leverage point for the state of Minnesota in maintaining its status as a premier education state here in the United States. And I've seen the research play out firsthand through my participation in the program and as well as a facilitator. The Minnesota Principals Academy represented a key stepping stone in my professional learning. After initial licensure, I wasn't ready right away to pursue advanced coursework like a PhD, and Minnesota Principals Academy provided me with a rigorous, ongoing environment for learning in a strong professional community and expanded my professional network beyond my own district. Currently, I have the opportunity to work with a current participant in the Minnesota Principals Academy, Mr. Eric Fort, who's with us here today. And one of the things that Minnesota Principal Academy is currently ramping up is its use of coaches. And so I have the ability to coach Mr. Eric Fort in his implementation of the Minnesota Principals Academy content and frameworks. Indeed, the Minnesota Principals Academy uses a number of key frameworks in helping principals to think critically about their work. Two such frameworks are the standards-based instructional system framework, as well as the strategic thinking framework. The Minnesota Principals Academy is somewhat unique in the work that it does. It has the opportunity to have faculty members from the University of Minnesota appear as guest lecturers at a variety of the units, and these are top researchers in their field. Further, as you heard earlier, we use the National Institute of School Leadership curriculum. It is research-based and is also unique in that it is the only principal development program that currently has a rigorous research study that has proven its positive impact on student learning. The National Institute for School Leadership also brings international and national perspectives to our work here in Minnesota. And in addition to the research in education that this program uses, it also brings in key research in business and military. One of the things that I've appreciated most about Minnesota Principals Academy is its responsiveness to its participants. We have been able to be in communication with folks at the National Institute of School Leadership and in conversations be able to inform their work to improve that program. And in addition, we have been responsive to participant needs here in the state of Minnesota. Recently, we added a unit on teacher evaluation in response to the new legislation. We were able to partner with the MDE, Greg Keith there, as well as Peter Olson Skog from one of the districts who ran a pilot program for teacher evaluation and be responsive to principals' needs in that way. So in conclusion, I just want to say that my participation in Minnesota Principals Academy had a profound impact on me professionally and therefore had a profound impact on the school. We were able to effectively manage a change process by creating a vision, developing school improvement plans, and then strategically executing those plans. And as a result, we were able to make systemic changes at the school that resulted in improved student learning, and narrowed our achievement gaps. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mao.
Well, thank you, committee, for the opportunity to speak today. I was hoping to briefly just touch upon a couple points that I've gained from the Principal Academy, and those would be the system thinking and strategic thinking that I feel I've gained from the experience, as well as the cohort model. And
for the tape, identify your name, Mr. Fort.
Sorry. I'm Eric Fort, assistant principal at Tartan High School. And then also take a moment to touch upon the data and the publications and the research base of the Principals Academy. For myself, as a third-year assistant principal who came from a non-traditional route, I can't express how valuable it has been to kind of go through that systems thinking approach and really looking at the big picture of things. As an assistant principal, it's very easy to get wrapped up in student management issues and working with, you know, students on behavior and things like that. For me, the Principals Academy has allowed me to take a consistent step back and look at the bigger picture of instruction, and then even relating instruction, how its instruction affects student management and learning and things like that. And as I said before, it's very easy to get wrapped up in the day-to-day, but having that time and that support to look at bigger questions of instruction has just been very valuable to me. I also would like to take a moment to talk a little bit about the cohort model, and I know there were some questions about the representation of outstate Minnesota. In our current cohort, we have about half of our population, I would say, is our principals are from outstate. And one thing that I've loved about that opportunity is growing up in the cities here, I never thought of being a principal in outstate, but that those dialogues have given me the opportunity to really learn some of the concerns that they go through, to learn the nature of the communities that they work in, and it's something that I could see myself definitely venturing out outside of the metro as a principal because of those interactions, because of some of the things that I've learned. You do learn about all the different benefits of many different communities by those interactions. So I felt that has been very, very beneficial. Another piece with the cohort model is we have so many programs that we run and things that we try with different students, and we've opened up a program called Fuel, in which we're really looking at those students who are having significant academic needs, but it's not due to a lack of skill or gaps in their education, but sometimes it's things outside of what we control in the school. And in talking to a couple different schools, they have run similar programs around the same time. And so we have ongoing discussions about the things that we're learning and the things that we're implementing. So that's been, again, invaluable for us. And I think the last piece that I was interested in discussing is the database and the data, the research. And in my preparation for becoming an assistant principal, we definitely did touch upon data and we learned some things. But having the opportunity to really be on the cutting edge of the data systems, whether it's the SLED system that is being currently used by the state or different databases like What Works in Schools, I feel like I'm able to quickly get information about what are some of the positive things out there, get ideas about the sample size, about the communities which they're happening in, and also tweak those for our population. So I feel like I wouldn't have been introduced to many of these experiences without the Principal's Academy. So,
thank you, Mr. Ford.
Thank you.
We have two additional people we'd like to present today, Roger Arnson and Gene Haar. Gene is from Minnesota State University, Mankato, and Mr. Arnson is the counsel for the Minnesota Elementary and Secondary School Principals Associations.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Roger Arnson. I represent the elementary and the secondary associations, and I did hear your earlier admonition about where you are on this, and you've kind of gotten to the point where everything's been said, but not everybody said it, as the old line goes. We have 1,800 school principals in Minnesota. We have had strong support for the Principals Academy at the university since it was created. It was created by this committee initially, and the numbers that it can serve, that's why I give you the 1,800 number. Senator Stumpf is absolutely right. We want to expand this throughout the state as much as we can and do that. We were disappointed when the funding fell out of it 2 years ago. We really hope that you're able to include us in the bill this year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Welcome, Ms. Hart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would reiterate what Roger Aronson just has said, that we very much validate, and you've heard the value of the Academy. I just want to affirm to you what Dr. Raskin shared, that our college and universities made a commitment to principal leadership. We have a solid research-based institute focused on equity and student achievement. Thank you, Senator Klassen, for including us in this bill.
Thank you, Dean Haar. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 524? Any further comments or questions from the committee? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Klassen, so is it fair to say then when the principals are working on their master's degree to get accredited as a principal, they don't really have time for these types of courses? And are we serving a demographic that has been maybe in the profession for 5 to 10 years that really need another kick or an upgrade or some of the skills that they really didn't get at when they got their master's degree?
Yes, Senator Dahl, I would say that this is more on-the-job training assistance. These would be people, for the most part, that are working in our schools across the state, and this is a staff development opportunity for them to become more effective in their jobs. And back in the early 1980s, I myself went through a principal's leadership academy. At that time, it was sponsored by the Blandon Foundation. And we had probably 40 to 50 people, but then we were placed in cohorts, and I was in a cohort with three other principals, and we had a project that we're working on together. And as I look back, that was very productive, and it was a great learning experience also, just kind of talking about the day-to-day things that you have to deal with and how to effectively do a good job in your position. So my own experience is very positive for these programs.
Sarah Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As one who's co-authored this bill in the past, I think this is an important measure, and I'm glad to see it coming back. I agree with the idea that we need to make sure that it is adequately available around the state. I just want to follow up on Ms. Raskin's points about the research that you're doing and make the request for down the road that when we have those results, I think it would be really great to get that report when we have it.
Thank you, Senator Kent, and thank you to each of the testifiers for sharing your success stories. Also, the recommendations that have been shared, which will get further review on its next stop for the bill. Senator Clausen moves that Senate File 524, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Further discussion? Not. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Senator Clausen. We now have before
Mr.
us Senator. Yes. And we now have Senate File 164, Senator Johnson, and would ask that your testifiers join you. I believe we have any handouts. Okay. Senator Johnson, Senate File 164.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill that was brought to me by Mr. Piccolo and the Charter School Association, asking for some new additional accountability measures for charter schools. This does not affect our public school system accountability measures. I have with me, in the interest of time, I'll ask Mr. Piccolo to describe the bill for you and hit on the high points that I think you need to know. I will say that this is really between the authorizers and the board at the certain charter schools. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr.
Thank you, Sarah Johnson. Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Eugene Piccolo, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning about Senate File 164, which is an accountability bill for particular charter schools. This legislation seeks to address two of the original purposes of charter schools. One is to measure learning outcomes and create different and innovative forms of measuring outcomes, and to establish new forms of accountability for schools. While it's not unfair to state that these two goals of the charter school law have not been in the spotlight over the years, the questions of how to measure outcomes in different and innovative ways and creating new forms of accountability have been at the center of discussion and debate among charter school leaders for years, especially leaders of charter schools that serve significant populations of at-risk or graduation incentives-eligible students. The scope of that discussion and debate expanded over the last several years as the role and responsibility of authorizers was better defined by the legislature. And authorizers, like schools, found that the current methods of measuring outcomes and school accountability to be inadequate to provide consistent and reliable information on how well these schools are serving at-risk students, as well as providing sufficient and quantifiable data to make judgments on how successful the schools are performing over time. So 3 years ago, the association gathered school directors and authorizers to move the discussion debate to a level of action. A work group was created that surveyed what schools were doing in terms of measuring outcomes in different ways and what data was being collected around those different outcomes. The group also looked at other states were doing to address measuring outcomes and accountability for schools that are serving at-risk students. We found a handful of states, like Colorado and California, and a couple other states that had already developed and were implementing terms of different outcome measures and accountability for schools that serve primarily at-risk students. Based on the research and the surveying, we developed a proposal, and essentially the proposal that we created is the basis for this legislation. So let me briefly just look at discuss a couple of key points of the legislation. This legislation would only be used by schools that serve significant populations of at-risk students, 70% or more, or if the charter was created to serve that population only. It would use these measures in the bill as the basis of contracts between the charter school and the authorizer. And there's three areas: academics, career and college readiness, and student engagement. And you can see on the sheet you have that we have developed for our members, schools, and so forth, a breakdown that there would be options under each of those three categories that schools would choose with their authorizer to develop goals that they would be held accountable for in their contract. We believe that this legislation fulfills the goals and purposes of the charter school law to create innovative frameworks for measuring learning outcomes for charter schools that serve these significant populations of at-risk or graduation incentives-eligible students. And it creates a sustainable framework of accountability for those schools with their authorizers by providing documentable measures to determine the success or lack of success in serving at-risk graduation incentive students. This legislation is but a first step. The real work for both schools and authorizers would begin once it's enacted. But I'm happy to report that there are two authorizers and a small group of schools that are already working to figure out different outcome measures, how schools will document those measures, and how authorizers will assess the achievement of those measures for contract renewal decisions. There is a critical need to have recognized accountability system for schools serving significant population of at-risk kids. So the decision about whether these schools are successful is not based on inadequate information and insufficient data, nor on anecdotal stories. The at-risk students who these charter schools serve deserve our best efforts to provide them with information on which schools are successfully serving students like themselves. Anything less than that is a disservice to these young people who already have significant barriers to overcome in being successful learners, economic players, and for some even being successful citizens. With that, I'd like to introduce Darius Hussein, Director of Face-to-Face Academy in St. Paul, to speak about how the current system of accountability affects schools, and David Greenberg, the Director of Charter School Authorizing for the Audubon Center of the North Wood, the largest authorizer in the state, speak about how authorizers see this issue.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
In addition, the Department of Education has some brief remarks that they would like to come forward with.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to begin by thanking you on behalf of our entire school community for this opportunity to testify on this vital issue. My name is Darius Hussein, and I am the Executive Director of Face-to-Face Academy. I've had this honor and privilege to serve the Academy for 14 out of the 16 years the school has existed. Face-to-Face is a small charter high school on the east side of St. Paul whose mission is to serve the most at risk for dropping out of high school. The Academy is often the last and best hope for earning a diploma. Our students come from immense poverty, as 93% qualify for free and reduced lunch. Over 70% represent racial groups that contribute to Minnesota's historic achievement gap. Their backgrounds include homelessness, early pregnancy and parenting, diagnosed and undiagnosed mental health concerns, drug and alcohol abuse, victims of physical and sexual assault, and juvenile delinquency. They have witnessed and been exposed to trauma and travesties that no child should ever have to experience. The result is that they arrive at the school overaged, undercredited, and uncertain about their future. Upon enrollment, the average face-to-face student is 17.8 years old and nearly 1.5 years behind their projected graduating class. Despite this grim picture, the Academy is a place of hope, optimism, and tremendous growth. Anyone who's walked through the doors will tell you that the Academy is making a significant difference in the lives of these students. Where the issue arises for our school and schools like Face-to-Face, however, is how this success can be quantified using data-driven metrics prevalent in today's educational landscape. In traditional measures of achievement, the Academy has admittedly mixed results. There are years where it has failed to make adequate yearly progress in math or reading or attendance or graduation rate. And there are years, like 2014, that the Academy has been recognized by the Minnesota Department of Education as a high-quality charter school, and even on the national level as being named one of Newsweek's top schools for beating the odds. This up-and-down nature is because governing bodies have struggled to find consistent and accurate ways to determine the value of schools like face-to-face. While we've come a long way from the singular metric of AYP, we still tend to fall into the trap of a one-size-fits-all approach. These approaches work fine for schools who have a representative sample of Minnesota's population on the whole, but what about schools whose very existence is to work with the most at risk, the most underserved, the child who has already been left behind? It is in these scenarios where the model breaks down. Let me give you a few quick examples. The MMR wisely takes into account individual student growth, but our students are coming from a place of such deficit that many don't even qualify for a growth score. Only 13 of the 41 students from last year's testing cohort, which had a 100% participation rate, qualified for a growth score because 28 were not even around or engaged enough at their school prior to face-to-face to actually take the test. Likewise, the metric to determine graduation-focused schools creates a disincentive for alternative programs to take on students that other schools have deemed a lost cause. It creates real-life situations in which a 19-year-old with no credits enrolls in an alternative school, attends only one day, and gets counted as the school's dropout. In fact, 4 of the 11 dropouts counted against face-to-face last year were not only over 17 years of age when they started at the school, but these 4 attended less than 11 days. The bill before you regarding alternative means of assessment addresses many of these concerns because it recognizes that schools like face-to-face are working under unique circumstances with unique populations. It holds the schools accountable for true year-to-year student growth by incorporating into its measures nationally normed tests that are not dependent on where the student did or did not attend previously. It allows for the utilization of college readiness measures such as the ACCUPLACER, a much more suitable test for our students who are realistically striving for enrollment in two-year community colleges. It takes into consideration that at-risk students not only need to perform in math and reading, but also must have character and social competency skills to gain and maintain jobs in our ever-increasing competitive economy. And the fact of the matter is that the achievement gap in these soft skill areas is just as great as the one in the core academic areas, as our students have learned and cultivated maladaptive behaviors on the hard streets of our cities. Most importantly, it allows state officials, authorizers, and school boards the right kind of flexibility to hold teachers and administrators accountable for what is clearly the most important mandate of our public schools, to prepare our students to be civically minded, engaged members of our society, and put positive contributors to the world's best workforce. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is David Greenberg. I'm the director of charter school authorizing at the Audubon Center of the North Woods. We're the largest charter school authorizer in Minnesota. We authorize 32 schools, which represents about 20% of the charter schools in the state, from Winona to Grand Portage to Bemidji, Minneapolis, St. Paul. 8 of our schools are high schools, or schools that serve students grades 7 through 12, and each of these schools has an enrollment below 100 students, with the smallest having enrollment of about 40 students. In a majority of these cases, as you've just heard, these are students who are coming to these schools who have not been served well by their previous schools, particularly at the high school level. So we see that they're coming in overaged, undercredited, and these schools will see more 10th graders than 9th graders, more 11th graders than 10th graders. These kids are coming in older and behind. These students must take the MCA assessments, and there's nothing in this bill that would move away from that. And these schools have to be evaluated by the state and the public and their authorizers based on those MCA assessments. However, as an authorizer, I understand the limited value of those assessments for these types of schools. For example, imagine a school that has 70 students, 20 of whom are in 11th grade. Those students would be taking the 11th grade MCA assessment in math. But maybe only 14 of those students were enrolled on October 1st. And maybe only for 7 of those students, maybe they've been there a year, or we might have growth scores. So as an authorizer, we're expected to evaluate the school's math performance based on 20% of the students, or maybe even 10% of the students. That it's not reasonable for me as an authorizer to determine the school's impact on math skills of students. It's unfair and ineffective. It's not enough information for us. The data is sparse. So as an authorizer, we work on behalf of the state, and our main role is to evaluate the performance of schools and make high-stakes decisions about their existence. As it says in statute, a charter school must design its programs to at least meet the outcomes adopted by the Commissioner for Public School Students. So central to our challenge is as it's currently written, is a school's performance on MCA assessments. How do we use those? Frankly, we're finding that the data is inadequate, it's unfair, and sometimes it's not even available if the school's too small. The schools also know this, and I think in some cases they want to say, well, we can't be evaluated. There's not enough information, so it creates this challenge for us to hold them accountable and make those decisions. But as an authorizer, Audubon, Center of the Northwoods, we don't accept that, and other authorizers don't either. We know that we must have systems to hold the schools accountable academically and to make those decisions, those systems don't exist currently in the state system. So as Mr. Piccolo mentioned, we're working with a couple of our schools, another authorizer as well, to set new goals and expectations for our schools. These will include student achievement on nationally normed assessments, post-secondary readiness on assessments such as the AccuPlacer, other engagement measures as well. We would be greatly empowered and to be able to more effectively set those goals and expectations and hold the schools accountable to those goals and expectations should this proposed language be put into statute. We know these schools are unique and committed to serving students who have not been effectively served in the past, but that does not necessarily mean that these schools are effective. We need to be able to evaluate their effectiveness. So Senate File 164 would provide schools, authorizers, the department, and the public with clear expectations and tools to do that evaluation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Greenberg. And we'll open for questions after we hear from the department. Sarah Johnson?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Adosh Uni, Department of Education. So I had the pleasure of meeting with the author and the stakeholders this morning just to clarify the department's concerns, and I think we reached some agreement about what the intent was, and they've stated it here that this is specifically setting up an accountability system between the authorizer and the charter school. And I expressed to them that as the bill is currently written, it does affect the state's accountability measure. So if you look at 1.14 to 1.20, the bill has the alternative measures mixing with the state accountability measures, so it would have an impact outside of the contract. As I understand it, that's not the intent of the bill, and we have offered to work with the author and Max to get that corrected. And we're happy to hear that the authorizers have expressed on the record that they're fully behind this and that this is truly a collaborative effort.
Thank you. That's noted. Questions, comments from the committee? Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the department. Would you say we have public schools that have similar characteristics?
Mr. Chair, Senator Clausen, yes, there are public schools that have similar characteristics, and I think if an alternative model was to expand outside of the pure contract, we would want to have an approach where it's all schools and not just charter schools. I think they face some they face the same challenges and should have the same opportunity of the relationship with whoever's evaluating their on accountability, which would be the state. But as I mentioned, if this is purely within the contract and setting up a relationship between the authorizer and the charter, I don't think it has as big of an impact on that public school or district schools. They're in the same relationship.
Follow up, Senator Clausen.
Just to follow up, has the department ever taken such a measure under consideration as what's being presented here for public schools?
I can't speak to our historical nature as of my relative newness at the department. I know the department has been presented with these ideas before in for public schools. I am more than happy to go back and look at the history of the considering those proposals.
Senator Clausen.
Yeah, just a comment. You know, I think what's being presented here is a very fair way of evaluating schools that have tremendous pressures and unique challenges. And I think it would be reflective of similar schools in the public area to have a similar evaluation that would really have a true, I think, evaluation of the effectiveness. So just a comment. So thank you.
Okay. Senator Johnson, then I will ask if there's anyone in the audience that would like to further address this. You know, the idea has been thrown out for non-charters as well in specific circumstances. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Piccolo whispered to me that alternative schools would like to have something like this, and I would ask if he could maybe make a comment. But secondly, I want to say that from the time that charter schools were put in place many years ago, the original intent was to provide some sort of projects or ideas that could be replicated by other schools. And I think this is an example of what is probably happening in this case.
Okay. Mr. Piccolo?
Mr. Chair, yes. We have had discussions with the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs, and they very much have endorsed this because some of their members are teachers in our schools. And I know they would very much like some kind of process like this for alternative schools that are under contract with their district and so forth.
Thank you. Ms. Gilbert. A little musical chairs there, but you're doing very well.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I just talked to the department about this. Some of the issues with the MMR rating that affect schools for new immigrants, like our LEAP Academy, have the same problem. We knock the socks off on the growth measures. I mean, these kids are often new to the country. They don't have any formal experience when they come. And LEAP Academy serves kids who come to us as secondary students. Where we get dinged is on the graduation rate. And not because the kids are dropping out. It's because they are being forced out because they age out at 21. And you've had those very compelling kids here begging you to allow them to stay. And so we have actually with the ESEA reauthorization, we did have a conversation with the department about that. Because a school like that shouldn't be getting labeled as a failing school if through no fault of their own the kids are being forced out of the school because they turned 21. So, and the department said, so we have had that conversation, but that's kind of our little history on that one.
Okay. Questions? And is there anyone else that would like to testify? Okay. Well, members, this would need to have some additional work done regarding amendments, but as we always do when it's laid over for possible inclusion, that would give the opportunity between now and markup for doing that. And the author, Senator Johnson, has indicated to work with the department as acknowledged and with others that are interested for possible amendments. And I would encourage members to work with Senator Johnson as your need would dictate. So, Senator Johnson, we will have Senate File 164 laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
And for the testifiers, we thank you for coming forward, and we'll continue to work on this.
Thank you.
Members, that concludes.
Did we vote?
The chair does, then we don't need to. If we want to formalize, we can, but I think we're good.
Okay. Thank you very much, and to my testifiers.
Thank you. And members, tomorrow we're going to have the E-12 budget from the governor's office or through the Department of Education. I believe you should have copies. We've posted different things. If you need anything additionally prior to the meeting, let our staff know. But I think we're set on that. Or as well, we have at least two reps from the department here now if you want to see them before you leave for any particular items. We also, on the last agenda, posted next week's hearings as well. And it might be tweaked a bit, but that's in place. And then we're working on the following weeks as well. So if there's anything you'd like to discuss with me personally regarding that agenda, as we get closer and closer to first deadline, please let me know. There being no further business, the committee is adjourned.